15 minutes after 4 o'clock, we welcome you to Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio, 101.7 FM. And we welcome our guest, Afra Raymond, the president of the JCC. And season's greetings to you.
Thank you, Hans, and welcome to the readers, to the listeners at Heritage Radio. Thank you for inviting me back to share GCC perspectives with the listeners on the important development issues in our country. And season's greetings to you. If I could say to you, in the words of my favorite song, Alegria, Alegria.
Okay.
This was my favorite song for this season, you know?
Yes. What is your Christmas season like?
Well, what is my Christmas season like? I'm just really trying to stay on top of many, many issues at this time. I don't celebrate Christmas very much. I don't get much of a chance. I may do a little bit of that this year, but it's really trying to sort of close off the year without any screeching disasters. It's a bit of trying to stay on top of many issues. Unfortunately, it's not that much fun. Mm-hmm. I get a little fun sometimes.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, but Christmas is important to you?
Yeah, it's a time of the year when for about 10 days, everything locks off and you do get a chance to reconsider, as I always say, the meaning of things. So it's important and it coincides with the end of the year. So it's a good chance to reboot before we go into next year's challenges for me.
Yeah. Just in case I miss it, were you appointed a senator yesterday?
I don't think so. I think the appointees yesterday were female, for one thing. Oh, no, there was Avinash Singh from Chokonas West. I'm sorry. But they were... And there was a lady who was a TV6, a newsreader. And, of course, there was Camille Robinson-Regis. So those things took us by surprise. Of course, I think there was rumors going around about Penny for a while. But, no, I wasn't appointed yesterday. And I don't expect to be appointed, quite frankly. Yeah.
Was that Pennywise?
It was indeed a moment that you have to kind of wondering which my rejoinder should be pound foolish. But seriously, I don't know what was giving, and I suppose we'll see, because Hines has made some mysterious statements that were reported in today's press about having been given a position or some sort of a role in the party beyond his senatorship, which leaves me a little bit intrigued. You know, Beckles was gracious in her departure. We haven't heard much from Robinson Regis, and I expect the opposition will make merry. The government will make merry with the opposition, I'm sorry, in relation to Robinson Regis and the sort of cloud that was reported to be hanging over her on some corruption related or allegations of corruption and the last wrongs, you know. And they will make fun with that, you know. It may be to their benefit, who knows? We'll see.
Okay, so now we can go to the JCC issues.
Mm-hmm. There's so many of them, eh? So many of them. Which particular ones do you want to tackle? I have about 12 issues I can talk about, but I can only talk about one at a time. Which one
do you
want to talk about?
Well, I don't know if it is on your list, and I need to do some homework. But there was a report in respect to a Canadian company called Geneva.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a few days ago in the press. Yeah. I saw that, yeah. And it was reported that Geneva had triumphed or
yes,
victorious
indeed.
In some sort of, I think there was one legal action and one arbitration hearing, one arbitration matter, with respect to fees that were owed for various professional services and reports and so on. And quite frankly, I saw what I saw in the press, and I've discussed a few things with a few colleagues, but I'm not fully briefed on it as I'd normally like to be. A couple of small remarks I could make at this time is that I was a little surprised to see in the press. It may not be true, but I saw it in the press. I was a little surprised to see in the press that Unicot appeared to be taking the line that the job was not a job for which they had a legal liability to pay, because the former chairman, which is Mr. Caller Hart, had not obtained board approval, and therefore it was an unauthorized exercise and so on and so on. And I could see that argument coming out in a lawsuit. But what I couldn't understand is that, in fact, the nature of the exercise was one in which significant people in Unicot would have had to be involved in briefing the consultants. The consultants report will be no small thing. That would have been delivered in considerable complexity and quantity and so on. So at some point, and they weren't exercises that took a week. These exercises went on for years. At some point, somebody must have been in receipt of documents that, quotation marks, Unicode never ordered, close quotation marks, and been able to say something. But so that was a little surprising to see. But the thing that really surprised me, and I was disappointed to read it, again, I read it in the press, I don't know if it's true, but it's reported that the head of Unicode, that's Mrs. Jolene John, was reluctant to discuss the details of the settlement or the lawsuit because, from what was reported, she said it was confidential. And the position we are taking on that is that the sums of money involved, I think it's some 20-something or 19, 20, 21 million Canadian dollars, is no small amount of Trinidad and Tobago dollars. And most importantly, those are sums of public money. And public money has to be administered to a higher level of transparency and accountability than private money. And you couldn't tell the owners of private money that, in fact, you can't tell them what really happened in this transaction or that transaction, because you would be fired. Okay? Somebody who was head of I forget the name of the company, if it's Donut Boys or Burger Boys, where did Mrs. John used to work for, one of those companies. You couldn't tell the owners of that company that you couldn't discuss for something with $25 million because you signed something that was confidential. You'd be dismissed. And the public money belongs to the people of Trinidad and Tobago. And we need to put a stop to this sort of veil of secrecy. You know, it's not a national security matter. Nobody wants to know the details of the helicopter or the bulletproof vest. These are buildings and studies about the same waterfront. I'm going to talk about the waterfront later. I need to remove the secrecy around these issues. We can't develop our country in secret. And interestingly, Hans, we had the same sort of attitude around public money emerging around First Citizens Bank. And the former CEO, Mr. Hawaii, left First Citizens and he's our current Minister of Finance and Economy. And there were widespread reports that there was a $10 million payout, a golden handshake or parachute, I'm not sure how it's described, but it was golden. It was reportedly golden to the tune of $10 million that Mr. Hawaii received before going in to become the Minister of Finance. And there was a lot of discussion in the public about it, on the media, the trade unions, different political discussions and so on. And Hawaii didn't say much. He's not a particularly talkative person. He didn't say much. But what disappointed me was to see Cleavon Raphael in The Guardian. Cleavon has his regular feature in The Sunday Guardian, a two-page interview with a prominent person. And Cleavon Raphael, a few weeks later, interviewed Nairi Dawn Alfonso, who's the attorney who's been appointed by the state, the government, to be chairwoman of First Citizens Bank. And he asked her, well, there was all this controversy about this reported $10 million paid to Mr. Hawaii. What can you give us a comment on that? And her reply was, no, she couldn't. It was banking confidentiality. So we have someone who's learned, an attorney at law, chairwoman of a large state corporation, who is mixing up, I don't know if it's intentional or it's accidental, he's mixing up the concept of banking confidentiality. That you, Hans Anumansing, have a bank account with a certain amount of money in it, and a banker observing that confidentiality shouldn't idly discuss your financial affairs, with the concept of public money. Because all of the money in FCB is public money, just as all the money that Unicode spends is public money. Of public money being transacted in some sort of a space under the table. And we need to move away from those notions and strive for more transparency in our dealings. So that's the opening points on the Geneva sort of issue, you know?
Yes. You're listening to Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio, 101.7 FM, month of December, coming to the end of the year, looking back, looking forward, issues of the Joint Consultative Committee.
Now, you have a particular one you want to talk about?
No.
In particular? Well, I would like to say that I would like to say to you that one of our main concerns at this time is the public procurement situation in the country.
Right.
And that has been a campaign of ours. It's been a decade-long campaign. And we've been We've been very fortunate to work with organizations that we consider our kindred associations in this important cause. Those would include the Trinidad and Tobago Transparency Institute, the Trinidad and Tobago Manufacturers Association, the Trinidad and Tobago Chamber of Industry and Commerce. We've been joined recently, and those 44 bodies I just named have put together a draft bill and laid that bill in the Joint Select Committee of Parliament since December 2010. And that's a complete draft law for procurement in our country. And procurement is a system that would control transactions in public money, which is what I just spoke about. Okay? And we've been happy to be joined now by the Federation of Independent Trade Unions and NGOs, FITUN, the American Chamber of Commerce, and most recently by the Local Content Chamber. So we now have an alliance, so to speak. I don't want to use the word coalition because it's misunderstood, but we have an alliance of seven organizations stretching all the way from the business service organizations, as they're called, the BSOs, the professional organizations represented under JCC's umbrella, and the civil society organizations represented by Transparency, and of course the trade union movement and the NGOs representing important wings of labor and civil society. This is unprecedented in the history of the Caribbean. We've come together for one cause for national development. We want those laws passed into being as the new procurement laws in this country. And we're still experiencing a significant amount of resistance. We've put very firm representations recently to Minister Tiwari, because he's the minister who's handling who's piloting the whole exercise for the state. And we expect to continue that struggle. It's going to be a robust struggle. We expect to continue insisting that the right thing be done.
How did he respond to you?
Well, he hasn't responded formally yet. There have been informal things that I wouldn't go into those things, but he's responded, but nothing formal as yet. Mm-hmm. So we would see. At all times, we keep striving to do the correct thing and to do it to the best possible standard. We've laid out five important points for the minister to understand that no proper procurement law could proceed without those 5 points. So we laid out what they are. Things like public money and independent regulators and civil society involvement and so on and so on. So those are things that we would continue insisting for. Very important in an end of year roundup to tell listeners that those struggles are persisting as well.
But you must have been given some kind of indication in terms of the legislative agenda and procurement.
Well, That one has me smiling, tired as I am, because the amount of indications we've been given over the last 3 years about when this is coming and when this is coming, it really requires a bit of something extra to keep a smile on one's face talking about this. This is a very frustrating exercise, but it's a necessary exercise for national development. Let me give you a concrete example, Hans, not to make a pun or a poor joke out of the construction industry's case. But last year, on the 10th of October, our Prime Minister stood up at the end of the budget debate, and it was on live TV, and the Prime Minister held two documents in her hands in the Parliament, and she told the Parliament very clearly that the allegations of corruption were of such great concern, the government was intended to take some action on it, and she was letting the nation know that the Prime Minister was filing two important documents with the Legislative Review Committee, which is a committee of cabinet. The first document the Prime Minister submitted to the LRC was the report of the Joint Select Committee on public procurement and the disposal of public property, which had been completed on the 4th of June 2012, and it was under the chairmanship of Dr. Tiwari. So that document went forward, which is what we would expect coming out of Parliament. And the second document the Prime Minister laid on the LRC was our document, the draft law I told you about, prepared by the Chamber of Commerce, the Manufacturers Association, the JCC, and the Transparency Institute. We prepared a draft law, and the Prime Minister said, this is an important law, and I'm going to put this in there. And it concerns us greatly that it appears at this time that our proposals have been silently sidelined, and government proposals that have been, to put it politely, hastily written in the last 2 or 3 months, and that they don't have the solidity to properly represent this very serious issue of corruption in our country. It doesn't matter who's in power. It's a very serious issue. They are very powerful forces that one has to try to contain and control if one is to get grip on this question of public expenditure, to control the use of public money. Very serious issues are at stake here, and what has been put forward as a government draft does not represent a proper, really workmanlike attempt to deal with those issues. And the country will suffer. So we're very concerned on that. We've written to Dr. Tiwari, and I'll leave it there for now. But we would like to see a solid response in the interest of developing the country and moving us away from this bad place that we are at the moment.
There is growing discussion. Mm-hmm. I think President Carmona, in his inaugural address, or it might have been this year's opening of Parliament, but he talked about a change in the approach to the functions of Parliament. For example, a Friday afternoon, which we've been doing now for 50 years.
Yes, yes.
And he says, especially after a heavy lunch.
Yes, indeed.
It is an insufficient allocation of time for the legislative agenda.
Yes.
And this should be not one afternoon, even if they go into the wee hours of the morning, but this should be a daily responsibility of the lawmakers.
Yes, I think those proposals had some merit. And if just to assist you on the point there, Hans, I think it was the opening of the parliament. It wasn't his inaugural address.
Yes,
it was the opening of the parliament. But I mean, just to bounce with you, on a perspective of that, I was doing some research last week for something that appeared in today's paper. And there's a list of public authorities held at the Freedom of Information Unit, which is part of the office of the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And it's tucked in the website, in the back of this, in the back of that, in the back of that. There's a list of public authorities. And in fact, that list is very useful because it gives you a kind of a view of what are the number of authorities that could spend public money or could engage in contracts, whether to receive or to spend public money in this country, lawfully, with any law. And do you know that there are 199 bodies on that list? It's 199 public authorities in this country.
Right.
And it's just amazing that a little country like ours, we have, 1.4, 1.5 million people, could have so many public authorities. And quite simply, the way things are going, we could end up having more and more and more and more and more because, you know, I guess bureaucracies are like organisms. They protect themselves and they reproduce themselves. So they just keep producing more children. If some limbs become irrelevant, they produce fresh limbs and so on and so on. So we really have to have a proper strategic set of measures to control how we run our public affairs. And that assists in the development and the stability of the society. Public procurement is a critical ingredient in that kind of intervention. You know, regardless of who's in power, it just literally doesn't matter anymore. It's very clear to anybody. It's a pattern, you know.
It's very clear. It's a pattern. It is glaring. How did you respond? It is still being raised, and it ought to be. I think in his farewell speech or contribution in the Senate yesterday, former Senator Hines raised the matter of the recovery of the fire tender.
The fire truck again. The fire truck wasn't something we took a formal position on because we were trying to fry some bigger fish. But I'll share a little vignette with you. One of those anecdotal ones. I was discussing it with a contractor colleague, one of my colleagues from JCC, who's a contractor, and trying to discuss some of the points about the letters and the offers and the fact that only one person was asked to do the job and that kind of thing. And we were debating whether it could be 2 million or 3 million or whatever, or 1 million, or whether they should have just left the truck down there and that kind of thing. And some other person just walked up, another contractor walked up and snorted and said, you're all ridiculous, you know. You could have actually built a road. It was only 30 feet below the main road. You could have actually built a road down there with a bulldozer. Not a proper road for a normal car to drive on, but a road for a recovery vehicle to go down. You could have built a road to go down there and pull the whole thing onto the main road for less than $500,000.
Yes.
He said he could have actually built a road with gravel and just a road that was good enough to make one trip down and one trip up. And that's what a real contractor would do if a machine belonging to you fell into that position. The idea that a real contractor in that position would spend $7 million to get back a machine it was worth, it's just not possible. So that's a quick response to that. There's been, of course, the revelation recently by the Minister of National Security. I think the new minister, Senator Gary Griffith, made a statement, I think it was yesterday or the day before, that no procurement rules have been followed in relation to the fire truck. And when I hear those things, I wonder. Of course, it's alarming at one level to think that $7 million could be spent with no observance of the rules. But I do wonder to what extent there's an agenda to inflict some kind of political damage, perhaps on the last Minister of National Security. You see, because we're into that kind of season. It appears to be stretching before us, and I guess until somebody dead, like an old stick fighting song. And that affects a lot of other things, because we get these statements made and you're not really ever sure. Well, is it true? Because if it's true, that's for the benefit of the doubt, say that it's true. If it's true what Griffith is saying, that none of the rules were followed, and obviously some of the blame would attach to former Minister Warner for that state of affairs. But if that is true, there's also the concept of the collective cabinet responsibility. Is cabinet also responsible? And I've raised that point already, there should be a vetting process to ensure that certain things don't get into cabinet. But it's clear to me that no such vetting process, no thorough, solid vetting process exists, because the kind of things that go to cabinet and get approved, that I've written about many, many times, whichever government is in power, is astonishing. And it wouldn't make muster at a normal board, at a real board of a real company. They wouldn't make muster. They would fall at the first or the second fence, and directors would never even hear about it.
I suppose it's also correct to say the kinds of things that don't get approved.
Well, there you go. Subsequent approvals. Retrospective.
Yes. You're listening to Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio 101.7 FM. The president of the JCC with us. Mm-hmm. He's got a list of 12 matters to deal with.
Oh, no, of course not. The other thing I wanted to mention, Hans, was talked about procurement, and we talked a little bit about the public money issue relating to the reported settlement between Geneva and Unicot of a claim for fees owed. And then we talked about the fire truck. And, of course, I'd like to speak about Invaders Bay, because I think Invaders Bay is a critical issue, and it is symbolic of the need to have these procurement laws. Because what we have is a scenario in which a huge development or series of developments is being contemplated, from all reports is being advanced, and those developments would take place on 70 acres of reclaimed land which belong to the state. Those lands are behind Movie Town in West Port of Spain, so in the capital city, and there are many aspects of it that concern us greatly. And I would highlight a few of them. And at the end of all of that, I'm going to make a particular call and use your radio station as a platform to do so. The first thing I would like to say is that there is a really serious issue with respect to the consultation at Invaders Bay. And the really serious issue I see is that the entire development process has been under the purview of the Ministry of Planning and Sustainable Development, which is Dr. Tiwari's ministry. And that ministry has a responsibility, as the title would imply, for the national development in the country, the physical planning, as we call it. And because of the title Sustainable Development, they've also absorbed into themselves a significant responsibility also for economic planning. So economic planning beyond physical development. What is striking, Hans, is that when you compare and you contrast what's happening at Invaders Bay with the rest of the country, it's shocking. In San Fernando, there are disused and derelict waterfront lands that we call King's Wharf, that we all know about. There have been development proposals going over several decades in King's Wharf. And at the moment, there is an active discussion taking place about what is to be done at King's Wharf. As far as I know, no contracts have been let to build anything. No leases have been granted to anybody, A, B, or C. No particular arrangement or agreement has been settled. And I have personally been invited to several meetings in San Fernando by a team of people. I think the MP for the area, Carolyn Sipasad-Bechan, who's a chief in the COP political party, has been instrumental in holding these meetings and so on. I think there are other people as well. So meetings have been held at Presentation College, at the waterfront itself, some of them at the San Fernando City Hall and so on and so on. I've been invited. I also know, because I'm privy to the sorts of notes that pass around after the meetings, I also know that various proposals and sketches have been presented. Some of them weren't received very well. Fishermen's groups have been there, some groups have protested and so on. I'm also aware that the said Ministry of Planning and Sustainable Development has had officers from its Town and Country Planning Division attached to that development process on the San Fernando waterfront, the King's Wharf development process. And what is striking is that at San Fernando, we have had a series of public consultations and the public views have been sought on a variety of options. And in Port of Spain, that has never happened. So we have an Invaders Bay situation where, in fact, there has never been a consultation. And when we ask Minister Tiwari, when did you consult anybody about this? His reply is to cite a meeting that we insisted on with him to discuss our serious concerns. And that meeting was after the RFP, the request for proposals, was published. Okay? Our point is that there must be consistent treatment of development to escape what Mr. Pandey used to repeatedly call a feeling of alienation. Good public administration must be reasonable, it must be consistent, and it must be transparent. That is all we are calling for. I'm going to go back to the OFF recommendations for a second, Hans. And the OFF report was completed in March 2010 by Professor John OFF and his colleagues into the public sector construction industry. And this government promised to implement the recommendations of the OFF report, the 17th one of which reads, user groups and other interest groups should be properly consulted on decisions regarding public building projects to ensure that relevant views can be expressed at the appropriate time and taken into account before decisions are made. Before decisions are made. And we would like, once again, I'm going to use this forum to make this call, we would like once again to issue a challenge, an invitation, a call to the Ministry of Planning and Sustainable Development and only very many professionals who work there. The Minister Tiwari, who is there. And we want to issue this call and this challenge to you. When are you keeping a public consultation on the possibilities of development at Invaders Bay? It is not acceptable to do a development on that scale in the capital city with no input whatsoever from the public. That's not acceptable in a democratic, vibrant, ambitious society like ours with all these diverse interests and so on. We at JCC have put certain points, but we don't think we have all the points. We're not going to have all the points till we get everybody together to start the conversation. Because it's very important, you know.
Is the Invaders Bay plan part of the master plan for the waterfront development?
That is a most intriguing question. Because the master plan for the waterfront development that you're referring to is one of the documents that Geneva prepared for UDICOT, which has started off our conversation. It was prepared at a cost, I think, of $17, $18, or $19 million, just under $20 million. And it covered the entire waterfront from roughly the lighthouse, which is called Katanga, all the way out to the little parking space and the lookout just before one gets the peaks west of Movie Town. And it was an attempt to do an urban plan of what were the alternative uses for those lands and, of course, what the principal target of that was, the Port Authority of Trinidad and Tobago. But there are also two other plans for Port of Spain, Hans, which were also paid for with public money. And those two plans, together with this waterfront plan, need to be considered. What is interesting is that the Invaders Bay RFP, the request for proposals, doesn't mention any of the existing plans. And in fact, truth to be told, the three existing plans have not been themselves consulted with the public, as I'm calling Fort Invaders Bay. They themselves need to be consulted. So what I'm saying in plain English, all of those things need to be put on the table for discussion so that the public can have a clear idea about what is possible, what is doable, what could the city look like if we do this, and what possibilities would emerge if we did this, this, and that. And then we could have an informed discussion about the future of our capital. So those plans need to be put forward for discussion as well as whatever is proposed at Invaders Bay. So it does include that, yeah.
Okay, so you're making a call for consultations. Are you aware of any commitments made? And I'm asking that question in the context of Mr. Chin, who was here.
Yes.
Well, maybe a year ago.
Okay.
But he was talking about his vision
for
the area and the things he wants to accomplish. Do you know about his proposals?
Well, yeah, his proposals are his proposals have been well ventilated in the press, and I think it's some kind of an extension of Movie Town.
Yes,
I think it's something to possibly called the streets of Trinidad and Tobago.
Correct.
I could be wrong. I think there's a cultural component to the thing. And they've been ventilated in the press, and they've been ventilated with remarkable confidence. I mean, Mr. Chin told the public 2 months before the RFP was published that he had met 19 cabinet ministers. He was going to see Tiwari the next week. Tiwari wanted to see him. Jolene John wanted to meet him, and so on and so on and so on. So we're really dealing with a question of tremendous access to gatekeepers, because the country's assets are always, in a substantive sense, they're always, to one extent or the other, in play. And the gatekeepers regulate who gets to play, who gets access to them or not. And we would like that sort of discourse, that sort of function of gatekeeping, to be more open to public oversight, which is what the transparency call is for, and the call for consultation and so on. That's what that's about, you know?
You're listening to Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio 101.7 FM with me, Afra Raymond, the president of the JCC, and we are looking at issues that dominate the thinking of the JCC.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond the waterfront, what are some of those?
Well, The other issues, Hans, the other big issue I'd mentioned is government-to-government arrangements, because this comes at the center of a national concern. It's beyond an industrial concern, because one could construe the JCC's concerns, probably to the greater or lesser extent, fairly. One could construe our concerns as being concerned with the welfare of our own industry and our own members. To which I would respond that our industry is the largest industry in the onshore economy. We employ the most people. We have tremendous linkages, whether it's transportation, hardware, many, many linkages, the food industry and so on. So the health and vibrancy of the local contracting and engineering and property industry is critical to the health and vibrancy of the overall economy. That said, the government-to-government arrangements and the whole question of local content, with the allied questions, and foreign participation in our economy, are critical questions for national development. I remind listeners that 1970, the social upheaval in 1970 that we have shorthand, we call it Black Power. The whole root of Black Power, one of the big roots of Black Power, was the belief that foreign people, people who didn't look like us, because of course there was a component, a strong component of race in the protest. People who didn't look like us were getting the best jobs and lived in the best areas and getting the best contracts and so on and so on. And it's ironic, because life is rich with irony, it's ironic that we seem to have swung back to a place where those concerns have now re-emerged with a vengeance at a time when NJAC, which is the group that led the 1970 protests is part of the coalition government. So irony is a very, it's a very funny thing. It just goes to show, you see. Now, what is concerning us about government-to-government arrangements, Hans, is that they actually put the country in a situation where our procurement process, the process by which we do our development, is outsourced. Our tendering process is outsourced. And all of the key controls, even the limited controls we have now, they're all sidelined by means of legal agreements. And I could tell you that nobody ever sees, because we have been trying. We've never seen a government-to-government arrangement. You hear about them. They keep a press conference, and it doesn't matter who's in power, this government or that one. And they announce that they're very pleased to announce that so has been agreed between the country and the other country. And it's off to the races. Huge contracts are given out. And under the framework we are using at the moment in Trinidad and Tobago, the framework we are using is one in which the government that is a donor feels free and has the right to name who the contractor is. Which means that there are two elements of political cloud hanging over that arrangement. And the first element, our country, in expenditure of public money, ought to be able to exercise some proper control over that by means of a tendering process and scoping the project and making sure that the project performance is properly monitored and so on and so on. That is gone. On the other hand, the country that is the donor country or the bigger country, the dominant country in the relationship, they also have the ability to, in fact, reward people who are politically favored. It's happened time and time again. We're seeing it with some of the Chinese companies. We saw it with SNC-Lavalin, the thing in Pinal. And they've been widely reported to have been involved in political funding of a particularly large scale within the Canadian scenario. And they somehow prevail time and again. And a lot of protests had to happen here for them to be dislodged. So it's an arrangement that's fundamentally not in our national interest. Now, let me be very clear that our proposed procurement laws, the ones I spoke about earlier, actually contain provisions that would control government-to-government arrangements. They wouldn't outlaw them. Any elected government has the discretion to enter an arrangement with this government or that government with whom they have friendly relations. We are putting safeguards in place so as to properly control the use of public money in those situations.
Once upon a time, Eric Williams thought that that was the answer, government-to-government relations, of all the problems.
Yes, indeed. It was considered to be a sort of a touchstone,
yes,
that would relieve all the problems. And of course, we now know, because we had the Bala report that was completed in 83, we now know, 25th of March, we now know that, in fact, that panacea, the government-to-government was supposed to represent, wasn't really so. You know, it wasn't really so. I can remember Chambers spoke in a budget speech after the Bala report came out, and this is Prime Minister George Chambers, who succeeded Dr. Eric Williams as Prime Minister. And Chambers actually said that, I think the title of the budget speech was Accounting for the Petrodollar. And he said, well, having looked at the Bala report and having considered everything, 2 out of every 3 petrodollars was wasted or stolen. So it's a colossal, and the picture now is no better. We need to do better. So and in fact, the standard of living could be much higher for everybody, with a lot more stability in the society.
You're listening to Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio 101.7 FM. We've got to take a break, and then we'll open up the lines for your questions, and we'll continue discussions with Afra Raymond.
Sure.
We continue with Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio 101.7 FM. My guest is Afra Raymond, president of the JCC, and he's raising issues of great concern to the JCC and, by extension, to the population.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about matters of the
government-to-government and
government-to-government,
local content and foreign participation.
Right.
And the point I was trying to make is that the current construct for government-to-government arrangements is one in which the donor government or the larger government can decide. They have the sole right to decide who gets a contract. And that's a coin with two sides. On our side of the coin, we are unable. We have taken ourselves by agreement. We've agreed to neutralize our country's fundamental safeguards of tendering processes and scoping of projects and so on and so on. And on the other side of the coin, the foreign state with whom we are in this government-to-government arrangement, by dint of the fact that the state has the discretion to decide who gets the contract to build the road or the bridge or the 20 schools.
Or the hospital.
Or the hospital, so to speak. They could that foreign government would then find itself also in a scenario where there's a certain amount of political favoritism in terms of who gets the contracts. Because the way it works in most countries in the world, if you're in, and you're in with the party that's in power and so on, you would get a favorable treatment. To use a phrase a prominent local contractor used recently, you get a favorable treatment, a favorable hearing, and you get treated very well. And if your group is out, you don't get treated very well. And so from both ends of the equation, we are not having the public interest represented either in the foreign country or in our country. But at a macroeconomic level, because it goes beyond a mere question of rules being followed and regulations being followed. At a macroeconomic level, there's a problem with this, because government-to-government arrangements in a scenario where a foreign government does not actually have a cogent expertise to construct something better than us. What we have is a scenario where, for a small country like Trinidad and Tobago, we are transferring tremendous amounts of our precious foreign exchange out of the country. Because when you give a contract, let us just compare like with like. You give a contract for a $200 million project to a local contractor. And the fact is that most of that, because a local contractor is based here, they live here, and their friends and their family are here. And some people do have money overseas. Most of that money stays in the country. And because of multipliers and how money works within an economy, benefits much wider than the close circle around the contractor within this country. When the contract is given to a foreign contractor, they will take out of the country every single penny that they can. That is their right in the contract. I'm not suggesting something illegal. I'm saying that a legal arrangement could produce an outcome that is not in our country's economic and social interest. We have to strive for economic and social justice, and therefore we need to strive for legal arrangements that serve those purposes. So I have no doubt that the government-to-government arrangements that various governments have signed, Mr. Patrick Manning, Mrs. Kamla Prasad Bisesa, Dr. Williams before, those agreements are probably legal in some purely jurisprudential sense, but they didn't serve the national interest, and the Bala report spoke to that. And Bala was an attorney, a very skilled attorney, who went through the government-to-government arrangements of 30 years ago in great detail. He received submissions from a wide range of people. And what's remarkable, because we're trying to discuss where there's a boundary between the legal rights of an agreement and the commercial and the spiritual and the moral aspects of the agreement. And Bala made the point that at every stage where an advantage could have been extracted in negotiation by Trinidad and Tobago with these foreign countries that were supposedly helping us to get developed, at every stage when those advantages could have been extracted, they weren't. So every single advantage that could have been extracted for our country, and by extracted, I don't mean some sort of process of duress. I'm talking about the natural course of vigorous negotiations. We never amassed the question. The capitulation was complete. And at this point, where you have to get philosophical and ask, well, what was the meaning of the independence and the republicanism and all of that stuff? What was the meaning of all of that? If the capitulation was so complete, and we have to restore proper sense of independence and republicanism, and that means having a proper balance and a focus in our foreign affairs, and that definitely means bringing proper control to the government-to-government arrangements. They must be properly controlled, okay? The government-to-government arrangements being entered at this point in time are detrimental to this country. This is the People's Partnership ones. The ones that Mr. Manning was entering, they were detrimental to this country. We protested it then, and we continue to protest it now. People in the country, students, listeners, trade unionists, become conscious, hold a conscious meditation, try to find out what is happening in our country, the size of these projects, where did they come from, at what cost, has the cost been budgeted, has it been something that we have actually planned to spend money on, can we afford these things, how long can this last? We need national development on terms that are beneficial, not only to the current generation, but to the generations beyond. And we wouldn't be able to have proper benefits flowing to the generations beyond unless we have some greater transparency in terms of what are the implications or what it is we're deciding. So government-to-government arrangements, hands and listeners, are very important arrangements in terms of how we do what it is we're trying to do. I want to make a point about that as well, relating back to procurement. I said before we took the break that our government-to-government arrangements are important for the development of the country. And I made the point that the public procurement proposals being advanced by the private sector civil society group, of which the JCC is part, definitely have proposals to control the transactions in public money within government-to-government arrangements. We're not letting government-to-government arrangements off the hook. I could say that the proposals being put forward by the government, because I've seen some of those, purposely omit government-to-government arrangements. And I want to say that again for the public. The proposals being put forward by the People's Partnership Government with respect to public procurement purposely omit government-to-government arrangements. And I want to say to the public again, I'm on the record, that is a most dangerous thing. That is a most reckless thing, because it is not a particular allegation against this government. This allegation stretches far and wide. This government or any subsequent government that wants to do a project outside of the public procurement safeguards simply has to designate it or call it, in straight English, a government-to-government arrangement. And they would say, no, this hospital is a government-to-government arrangement. We can't discuss it. Sort of like an echo of what Mrs. Jolene John said at the start of the interview. You know, this hospital might be $200 million or $300 million. We can't discuss it because, you see, this piece of paper says government-to-government. And we don't want that in this country anymore. We want a situation where our natural resources, our future resources, our future in this country, our money in this country, our public money in this country receives a proper level and a high level of transparency and accountability. The public must understand what is happening in this country. And this is the role JCC is playing at this time. I'm honored to lead JCC at this time. And we have to insist on a proper standard. And it is across the board. It doesn't matter whether it was Mr. Patrick Manning a few years ago. At this moment, it is Mrs. Kamala Prasad Bisesa. Next month, it could be somebody else. But whoever it is, we would insist that the proper thing be done. It's not partisan politics here at all. It's national development for the country's development.
You don't want an election next month, do
of
you?
Course not. We're sick of them. Next month is the month before Carnival. We can't have that.
You're listening to Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio 101.7 FM. Mm-hmm. And Afra Raymond would be happy to have some dialogue with you. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you can join us 628-4846, 628-3896. We'll take your calls now, mm-hmm. and we'll continue to talk with Afra as well, sure. on matters of procurement, matters generally of concern, by the JCC taking the leadership in a number of critical areas. Welcome to our program.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Raymond.
Yes, good day.
Mr. Raymond?
Yes, good day.
Yeah, I had the opportunity of witnessing the government arrangement with the German company, Secondary Roads Company. 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of that period?
Well, I was very young, but I know about the company and I heard about it. Go on, I'm interested.
Right, and they came and a company, the Secondary Roads Company, was formed. And they redeveloped St. Augustine constituency for the government at the time.
Right.
You see where Tunapuna Hindu School is now?
Mm-hmm.
That was known as Kali.
Yes.
And they went in there and they redeveloped the area, all mm-hmm. Pase, mm-hmm. Kearney, Curep, and so on.
Okay.
And 30 years now, the roads are still standing.
Yes.
They developed the area in Kali to the extent that it can be considered the new Valsane of North Trinidad.
Okay.
But before I go there, would you say that the new procurement legislation will speed up, or like the present tendering process, the issuing of contracts?
It ought to speed up the system, yeah. That's correct. It ought to speed up the system.
And there would not be as much frustration.
There wouldn't be as much frustration because the ability...
That's important.
That is very important. That's one of the things we're working towards. Because what I want to say to you, caller, is that we who are putting this forward, we are practitioners.
Right. No,
we are not civil servants. We're going to put something forward to tie up our own self. We want to put something forward that if a piece of business is to be put out on a contract, it is put out on a fair, transparent basis. You compete... A, B, or C will win it, and you do the work smoothly, and you get paid smoothly. This is what the country needs. This is what the country needs, and this is why we put it forward in that way.
And I am surprised.
So I'm happy you asked that question.
It is taking so long to come on the books.
Well, yeah, it is even the party that is in waiting.
Yeah.
I mean, we have the PNM there; they're waiting to sort of compete in an election and so on. We don't know what the PNM position is on public procurement. They've never said.
But I'll try to influence that in the PNM.
Well, if you could, that'll be nice.
But another point I want
to make
is that,
you go ahead.
Jennifer formulated a redevelopment plan and this redesign plan for Port of Spain.
Correct.
Which I believe is ideal for a modern city.
Right.
And that plan, I saw the plan when I was in the Ministry of Local Government.
Okay.
That plan would have taken care of all the flooding and so on.
Well, you see, what is interesting,
and
I mean, this is a good dialogue we have in here. What is interesting is that I have never seen that plan.
I saw the plan.
And I'm supposed to be a specialist and so on and so on. I've never seen the plan. The plan is like a secret. Okay, and this is why I made the point. That's why I made the point to Hans, who's my interviewer, earlier on before the break, that all of the plans, the three plans that are paid for by public money, as well as the Invaders Bay plans by the various developers, need to be put on the table so we could see what are the possibilities. What is being discussed? But at this point in time, it's only rumors.
I just raised it with the new mayor of Port of Spain.
Okay.
As a pity that Geneva has come up in the newspaper yesterday or today.
Mm-hmm.
That he should ask Unicode to show him the plan.
Okay.
So he could champion this plan. Mm-hmm. Because it is a fantastic redesign and modernization of Port of Spain. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you. Good evening.
Heritage Radio, welcome to our program.
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, Mr. Raymond.
Yes, good evening.
I support in principle the idea that whatever we could do here with our technology, our money, our people and so on, that we do it. Because I understand the value of money circulating.
Good.
Within a community or country.
Yes.
But when somehow over the years we have come to believe, people like myself, that when you get a big foreign contractor, it might cost a few dollars more, but you will get the thing done.
Mm-hmm.
You will get your highway, this highway that we are getting, that is so sorely and badly needed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have looked at it from the point of view of the traffic and how it would alleviate the traffic and so on. And, of course, all of the hydrology concerns and this and that could be addressed.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not going to be difficult. I could tell you that. I've lived here all my life, and I've watched it.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes, you know, we feel that the big foreign contractor under government-to-government arrangement will help. I want you to explore in a minute or two, if you can.
Sure.
The benefits of these government-to-government arrangements and versus... trying to do big things on our own.
Sure. Let me just deal with that, with those points from that particular caller. First of all, the government-to-government arrangements would give the contractor local to a foreign contractor. And, of course, there are other arrangements that are not government-to-government that give contracts to foreign contractors. So two big things that are taking place at the moment. You mentioned one, the Point 14 Highway. And, of course, there's the controversial UBDB that is being constructed by China, Jiangsu, which had tremendous difficulties under the Manning regime in terms of completing projects. Let me say to you that one of the concerns addressed in the OFF Commission of Inquiries, a two-year-long Commission of Inquiry that took place in this country that completed its work in March 2010, one of the concerns addressed in that Commission of Inquiry was this very point you're raising. Is it better to use foreign or is it better to use local contractors or consultants? And in the course of the inquiry, I've studied about 20 or 30 leading large-scale projects over the subject of big controversy. And his conclusion was that it is no better to use one type of contractor or the other. There's no simple answer. There are certain areas in which foreign contractors possess an undoubted expertise, and there are certain areas where local contractors possess an undoubted expertise. There's no winner as far as that is concerned. I mean, look at Shanghai Construction, just to call a name. Okay, we have Shanghai Construction that is at the moment, I think they're the ones who've been selected to do the Kuva Children's Hospital under a government-to-government arrangement. And there have been tremendous challenges where NAPA is concerned, tremendous challenges where the Prime Minister's residence and diplomatic center were concerned. And they continue to get work. And this is one of the issues of the government-to-government scenario, as it is currently practiced, is that there is no opportunity without a lot of protests and noise and so on. There's no civilized opportunity to remove from consideration a contractor who hasn't performed, which can happen to a local contractor, okay? And those are the reasons that we caution against that. Of course, going back to your first point, caller, the main reason is the circulation of money within our own economy. And we have to take measures that improve, to borrow a phrase from Minister Tiwari's title of his ministry, planning and sustainable development. And planning and sustainable development could only happen with the people's involvement. It could only happen in a scenario where we are planning, serious long-term planning, to keep as much of that money, of our country's money, our public money, in the country for the prosperity of our people. That is how it could happen. So that's my short answer on that point.
Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio, 101.7 FM, 628-4846, 628-3896. With us, Afra Raymond, the president of the JCC. Mm-hmm. And we're keeping the lines open as well for your calls. The last caller mm-hmm. has seen the reports, Afra.
Well, he's a better connected man than me. I've asked over and over, and all I get is a mysterious laugh and a shake of the head. I've not seen the reports, you know, and this is part of the conundrum. You know, my column today was called a secret society. This is part of the conundrum. So we have these three reports. Forget Minister Tiwari and Invaders Bay for a minute. Let's give him a break for 30 seconds. We have these three reports produced at various times, all of which cost public money. We have a report for Port of Spain, and we have a report for the waterfront that we just spoke about, and I think there's one for East Port of Spain as well. And we haven't had an opportunity publicly to put those, as I said to you, to put those three things on the table and compare and contrast, or a process that would allow us to understand the implications of these three reports all being in existence with proposals at the same time for the same, virtually the same land space. And then you put into the mix Invaders Bay, which is a large new piece of land because it's reclaimed land. And we have serious planning issues to be discussed. And it's ironic that the Ministry of Planning is advancing with a process that appears, on the one hand, to be embracing consultation and participation if you're in San Fernando at King's Wharf, and on the other hand, discarding and disregarding consultation and collaboration if you're the Port of Spain waterfront at Invaders Bay. And those sorts of blatant double standards, they're unprofessional. They don't promote development. They don't promote public confidence. And we need to discard those perspectives. And all of these large-scale projects need to be consulted. So once again, I think you told me earlier on that you have some important people who listen to the radio station, the station habitually. Once again, to all of you important listeners, the challenge is on you. Okay, all of you professional people working in these ministries, the challenge is on you. We have to insist that the correct thing be done. And you know what the correct thing is.
You're listening to Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio. You made mm-hmm. reference to the Huff Commission of Inquiry mm-hmm. and the recommendations
yes.
and the non-recommendations. And for a long time, the population has not been excited about commissions of inquiry because implementation has mm-hmm. been absent. Mm-hmm. And that is over the years, different administrations, it's the same thing. A commission of inquiry, end of the commission of inquiry, a report, and then that's it.
Yes, yes. Yeah? Well, that is a very serious and widely held public concern. And some people go even further. Some say, well, in fact, nobody get locked up and the commission doesn't hold anybody and so on and so on. Of course, there are the recent examples of the Coleman Commission and the Coup Commission, when some of the main people, I think it was Abubakar and Mondai and Dupree and so, wouldn't testify.
That's right.
And so on. Pardon me. So those public concerns are widely held, and I have to say most of them are well-founded. I happen to think that the commissions of inquiry are a worthy exercise, because what they do is they give us a quality of information, a quality of detail about what is happening in national affairs, that quite simply, when all of the complaints are over, and I hear all the complaints and the skeptical perspectives and so, when all of those are over, we wouldn't have had that information had it not been for Commission of Inquiry. We would have been left to wallow in rumor and surmise, well, I wonder if this is why this happened and so on. And in fact, a commission of inquiry is a forum in which the various parties would come and put their perspectives most times. Okay? So it's a worthwhile exercise in terms of developing. I happen to think that fundamental to development is information. And the information has to be placed in a way that you could access it and understand what it all means. And that process of a commission of inquiry that is televised and available on the web and so on is an important part of the process. The only criticism I would make of them as they're conducted is that they need to make better use of graphical ways of presenting information, okay, in terms of graphs and maps and tables and so on. The point I want to say to you as well, Hans, is that when I look at what's happening at Invaders Bay and I look at the 17th of recommendation about the need for widespread public consultation before decisions are taken, and I think about the commissions of inquiry we've had in the country and the dissatisfaction that we've had with those commissions of inquiry, well-founded dissatisfaction. When I think about all of those things, I am starting to ask myself personally, this is me personally, JCC is not quite there yet, I'm starting to ask myself whether in fact we don't need to have some kind of inquiry, an investigation, or maybe even an open review. And that could be part of a process that we call a widely based consultation into what is happening at Invaders Bay. The Invaders Bay matter is wrong on so many levels. It's wrong on the level of consultation, as I said, the blatant double standards between San Fernando and Port of Spain in terms of consultation. The rules to evaluate the tenders that were received, the rules to evaluate the tenders, weren't published until after the tender date had closed, which is, on the first surface of it, what the lawyers call it, ipso facto. It's on the surface of it that makes the entire process voidable, an illegal process. Okay? In addition, a ministry is seeking tenders. Ministries are not supposed to seek tenders above $1 million, according to the Central Tenders Board Act. And that is another matter where we have the JCC has actually challenged the Minister of Planning and Sustainable Development on the legal advice that was received, and we have that matter before. So we are really looking to have some kind of an open investigation into what's happening there. I guess we have a call coming in.
And welcome to our program.
Gentlemen, good evening.
Good evening.
Good day.
The core problem is weak political leadership. If there was a worthy Prime Minister sitting in office, the minister of whatever could not feel that he could get away with that type of thing. The previous administration, same issue, weak leadership. Put the locals to work in CPEP, import the Chinese, in the hope that his political ambitions could be displayed for the country to gloat on by finishing his ambitious waterfront project in record time by utilizing slave labor. Laborers that were sleeping in containers on a shift basis. Are our memories so short? So we saddled with weak political leadership. And until that political problem is solved, we're going to be stuck in this quagmire. And all of the agitating by the JCC, and I really appreciate Mr. Raymond's point of view. He's speaking a lot of very, very knowledgeable and very well-spoken and philosophically correct. We're expending our oil money on foreigners who leave no value in the country. Mm-hmm. But until we fix the political leadership, we're going to be saddled with these issues, and that is the core reality. Thank you and good evening.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. 628-4846, 628-3896.
Well, that is one of those rare occasions when I'm going to say to you that I really wish I could say more, and I wish I could comment. But, of course, JCC is a non-partisan. Our calls are very often political in nature, but we don't make any party political calls. I don't really have any comment on the last caller. I mean, it seems that he made some sharp observations, and he appreciates our efforts, and we will continue, okay? But we're really facing a situation where fundamental decisions are being taken at a strategic level, national decisions of real importance, and those decisions are being taken in conditions of secrecy. They're detrimental to the country's short-term and long-term interests, and there does not appear, which is what I spoke about today in the secret society, there does not appear to be an easy channel for us to discover what is really being done in our names. How are we being traded? I mean, I'll give a little example, Hans. Related to the construction industry, I'm not straying far out of my crease, and related to national development. The Premier of China, I think the President of China was here, and the People's Republic of China was here for the first week of June this year. And there were a number of high-level meetings and so on. He was here for 4 or 5 days. And on the 2nd of June, I was astonished to see published in the Express an article in which Lake Asphalt of Trinidad and Tobago had a ceremony where they signed an agreement, what they call an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, with a Chinese company, the name of which I don't remember, a Chinese state-owned company, for the development or the exploitation of the Pitch Lake. And they signed it at a hotel in Port of Spain, and it was a big thing, and there were photographs, and everybody was thing and so on, shaking hands and so on. And at the same time as signing the government-to-government arrangement, they signed a confidentiality agreement, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a legal device intended to defeat the Freedom of Information Act. You are trying to create another cloak of secrecy. So we in Trinidad and Tobago, and I said earlier on, I spoke about students, I spoke about business people, I spoke about academics, I spoke about contractors, and I'm saying we have to be conscious about our country. The Pitch Lake is one of our national assets. What was in that agreement? What have we agreed to do? At what price? For how many years? Is it 2 cents? Is it $2 billion? Is it $2 million? How does it work? Do we get the money in advance? Is it quarterly? Is it in US? Is it in TT? We don't have any idea. Confidentiality agreement. And this sort of dealing with national assets, with public assets, is unacceptable. It's an unacceptable series of transactions with public money that needs to be exposed to proper scrutiny, which is all of what we are battling for in terms of the public procurement reforms. So thanks for your support, callers, and Heritage
Radio. Is there a process for accountability for the implementation of reports coming out of commissions of inquiry and approved by the government?
Well, that's interesting. I'm glad you asked that. We took up a particular interest in that, JCC, and we have been writing to successive ministers of government. We've written to the Attorney General 3 times on this question. And I would just put for a bit of context, Hans, I would say that the importance of People's Partnership attached to the implementation of the OFF recommendations, we took heart from the fact, and I don't mean to make a joke when I say we took heart, we took heart from the fact that at the very first post-cabinet press briefing of the People's Partnership Cabinet, 1st of July 2010, the very first item of the agenda from the very first post-cabinet press briefing
was the Prime Minister telling the press that we are going to implement the OFF recommendations. And I have asked the Minister of Justice to give us an action plan in 6 weeks. It was Mr. Volney at the time. To give us an action plan in 6 weeks of how we're going to do this. Everybody was excited. But of course, that was 3.5 years ago. You know, it was May of 2010. You're young in December of 2013. And it's looking different. Because I could tell you that they haven't been implemented. Okay? No state agency or ministry has implemented all of those recommendations. Some have implemented some. It's like a brand term. You push your hand and you take which ones you like. You don't like this one, you put it back. Okay? And that kind of free-for-all approach and that kind of laissez-faire approach exposes the state to particular perils in terms of people being able to go into particular organizations and do what they want to do. So the point I'm getting at is that A.G. Ramlogan directed us to the Minister of Justice. Because there's two things we were seeking. We were seeking the implementation of the OFF recommendations, and we were seeking the publication, or I should say the republication of the OFF proceedings, because the proceedings of the Commission of Inquiry, I want to tell listeners, had been deliberately, it seems, expunged from the record. So in fact, there used to be a website, www.constructioninquiry.gov.tt, that contained the OFF inquiry. And all of the testimony was there. You could have gone and read it and done research and so on. And a few months after that election in May 2010, that website disappeared. Now, of course, we all know, those of us who are into this world, we all know the information still exists somewhere out there, just so we can't get it. We then took up writing to Minister Volney, who never replied to 4 or 5 letters. He eventually met us last year in May to discuss the judicial centres. We were very concerned about that. And in that meeting, we had a little discussion about the OFF recommendations and the OFF proceedings. We then went on to write to Chrislyn Moore, who followed Volney as Minister of Justice. And that minister took a peculiar position in that she was saying that, in fact, she couldn't publish the OFF proceedings, which is actually what took place at the inquiry, because that would jeopardize prosecutions that they were considering and so on and so on. So we had to challenge her on that, and we went back and forth. Of course, she's now no longer in office, and we have a new Minister of Justice, which is the former Minister of Works. I think he was with Works before, Emmanuel George. So we would be taking up the issue with him. We're not going away. It's not a partisan effort. It wasn't anything against Volney or Ramlogan. We are interested in getting these proper principles observed. The government gave us a promise, and we take that promise seriously. The promise is that you want to implement those recommendations, and we need to see that they're implemented in the country's interest. As we have said, Hans, 90, before any politicians come here and tell you that, in fact, by doing the procurement law, they're implementing it, only one of the 91 recommendations refers to the new procurement law. 90 of the 91 recommendations could be implemented without any need to go to Parliament to pass any new law or any need for PNM support. They are changes in rules, guidelines, and procedures. Important changes that the country needs, changes we could have done 3.5 years ago, changes that the JCC and our civil society compatriots in the Transparency Institute offered to delegate members onto a working party to see that the changes were done properly and conformed to the existing framework and so on. And we remain ready. If the current Minister of Justice, that is Minister Emmanuel George, would like to start on the exercise, we would like to start on it too. Okay.
JCC had an intervention. Mm-hmm. In the matter between Dr. Kublal Singh,
yes,
and the Ministry of Works.
Yes. That was, I prefer to characterize that as an intervention between the Highway Reroute Movement.
Okay.
To put it properly, the Highway Reroute Movement and NITCO.
Yeah.
NITCO was the government's implementing agency, and the Highway Reroute Movement was represented by Wayne Kublal Singh, Dr. Kublal Singh, who was on a hunger strike. And it really presented us with a ghastly challenge in the country, because there was the unwelcome possibility that somebody could have lost their life, all out of a sense of political grand charge and so on. And the situation was deteriorating badly. So we had Dr. Kublal Singh himself, which is a fellow who's very gentle and mild in his manner. I think he lost his temper at one point, and I think he cursed I think it's Khan, the Minister of Health, that he might have cursed Khan.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we had one minister of government, I think it was Muilal, making remarks about Kublal Singh's family. And those remarks, I wouldn't repeat them on the air, but they verge on the obscene from a political, a Monday night meeting or Tuesday night meeting or something. And then we had Warner saying, I don't know why this man doesn't hurry up and dead. And the thing was getting into a place where it could not have ended nicely. So we made an intervention, and by we, I mean the JCC, the Transparency Institute, FITUN, Federation of Independent Trade Unions and NGOs, and Working Women. We made an intervention by writing to the Prime Minister and proposing a process to examine the contending claims on the highway and to be able to make a report, to review what has taken place so far and make a report in the interest of settling this debate that was boiling to an intolerable point. And cutting a very long story short, our proposal was accepted. It took a lot of negotiation behind the scenes and things I wouldn't talk about and so on. We had to meet and discuss and so on. And we had to agree the terms of reference for the review. And that terms of reference had to be agreed by both of the parties, which is the Highway Rail Movement and NITCO, because they were the two principal protagonists in the matter. And the group had 60 days to do its work. And I'm pleased to say, I'm going to go on air and say it to my colleagues, I'm pleased to say that colleagues performed beyond the call of duty. Everybody who worked on that project worked at a greatly reduced fee. Okay? That isn't something you hear. You hear much in terms of public service these days, people doing work below the reduced fee. But I could say that it was 19 Caribbean professionals of excellence. There was only one person in the group of 19 professionals who's not a Caribbean person. And that's a person from Holland who's a drainage engineer, a drainage specialist. He knows who he is. And he's been welcomed as a Trinidadian and Tobago brother. He's lived here long enough. He's one of us. But 18 out of 19 people were Caribbean people of excellence. And it's a very important thing. The government agreed and they paid a significant part of the cost. I think it was 70 or 75%. We paid the rest. And the report was completed on time. They worked through 60 days. They worked through the Christmas period, because it started on the 5th of December. And they worked through the Carnival period. And they completed the report the Friday before Carnival Friday. It was down to the line like that. On the actual 60th day, they completed the report. I know for a fact that they worked nights, late nights, after midnight, weekends, 7 days a week, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, they were working right through to get this vast volume of work digested and produced. And I want to pause here, Hans, and interject in a counterpoint to some of the callers we had earlier, that in fact there's a kind of a popular perspective or emotion or sentiment that is out there that we can't change very much and there is much we could do. And yes, thanks for doing this work. People may thank the JCC, but nothing much could change. And I want to say that intervention on the Point 14 Highway, as it's called, the Debe Mondesiri Link, the intervention between the HRM and the NITCO, which is the forces of the state, was a significant intervention. It was a first time in Caribbean civilization. We need to get a context and understand what's happening. It's the first time in the history of the Caribbean that there was a project review by civil society of a large-scale state-sponsored project. That project review was carried out within budget, within time, to international standards. We have had international centers of learning writing to us, wanting to know how we did it. What was the nature of the intervention? What were the philosophies guiding us in doing the review? It was an independent highway review committee under the chairmanship of former independent senator, Dr. James Armstrong. James is one of our esteemed colleagues. And he performed a very high standard. I want to take the opportunity here in the media to thank the colleagues, especially James and the support staff who worked 24/7 to get this piece of work done. And that report, completed on time, had the effect of calling off the hunger strike. And in fact, it's being litigated upon at the moment in the court. I won't say too much about that, but it's being litigated on at the moment between the two groups, between NITCO and the Highway Rail Movement, as to whether the report will be admitted and whether, in fact, the political administration did or did not make a promise to comply with the terms of the report and its recommendations. Okay? To my mind, a promise was made tacitly and explicitly. but I'm not a judge. I'm just saying how I view the situation. And it was an important stage in national development because what it showed us is that civil society could have an intervention on a large-scale development project where, in fact, civil society ought to have a standing role in relation to these questions, which is what I've been advocating from the start of the interview all the way down to now. So that particular intervention a year ago on the highway reroute movement and for JCC to form a highway review committee together with our colleagues in Transparency, in Phaeton, and in Working Women was a very important stage in Caribbean development, not just physical development, but social and philosophical development, because you're dealing with a situation where our people are coming to the center of the discussion and having an influence peacefully in a better quality of development in the country. So it's a piece of work we're very honored to have taken part in it. It's available on our website, www.jcc.org.tt. The report is available as well as the correspondence. So it's a piece of, now a public asset. It's been published in what they call the Commons. So you can see it and read its implications and so on. Available on the JCC's website, you can see that. And that's very important for us to note that civil society made a breakthrough, albeit in circumstances that were unpleasant because of the hunger strike and the whole political atmosphere degenerating. But sometimes you have to go backward in order to go forward, and progress can come out of demanding circumstances, you know?
2014.
It seems like a big number. It's only a few weeks away. Yeah. I think we're really hoping to have a proper settlement of the public procurement issue and a proper settlement of the public procurement issue. In our collective view, would mean that the issues we have represented, the centrality of public money, the independence of the regulator and the commissioner, the role of civil society, the role of agency, and so on, all of the fact that these people report directly to Parliament, all of these things would have to be at the center and entrenched in any public procurement regulations or laws we put forward in this country. We need those laws like yesterday. The situation is very serious. It doesn't matter. I say this again. It doesn't matter who's in power. Another group could win next month. Another group could win next 6 months. And the challenges would remain the same.
And the same group could be re-elected.
Exactly. The group that is currently in office could return a year later.
Yeah.
Because that is the political challenging and turmoil period we live in. Yes. So we have to be aware that we need proper laws to ensure stability and development in our country. And we need to have a framework that is based on the correct philosophy and so on.
Well, thank you very much. And good discussion. Time goes quickly.
Indeed. Thanks very much, Hans. Thank you, Heritage Radio. Thank you.
Feliz Navidad.
Yes. Alegría.
Thank you very much, Afra Raymond, President of the JCC, bringing us to the end of this afternoon's presentation of Issues and Perspectives on Heritage Radio 101.7 FM.